Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are here to hopefully inform you, possibly with a lot of straining involved, entertain you, and talk about economics at the same time. I know. Inform, entertain, and talk about economics. It sounds like we've got three different subjects for the radio program, but hopefully it will all be one subject. Don't ask us about sports. Seriously. Neither of us, well, maybe, I haven't checked with you recently. Do you know who won the Super Bowl last year?
No. Did we play the Super Bowl last year?
We are being serious here, folks. As odd as it sounds, neither one of us knows who won the Super Bowl last year. That is not our sport, nor is tennis, nor is basketball. Organized sports in general, not for us. But we do understand the economy. And I got this question in the middle of the day yesterday from a podcast listener, Arlen. Thank you, Arlen, for listening, by the way. He says, hope all is well. One of the messages I've heard from you and Jeff over the last few episodes is that fear in the market is generally a good thing. The saying is to support that is bull markets climb a wall of worry. But I'm still not quite grasping why that's good. Does it keep the market from getting out of control? Thanks, Arlen. Okay, so Arlen, that's a fantastic question. And we have been remiss in not explaining this more. Do you mind if we delve into the past a minute?
Okay. You got 1 minute. Time started.
A minute. Oh, no. We're going to need more. Well, if we're going into the past, I'll just use past time to fill up this time. Then
this is your. So this is your past time?
Yeah. And this is something that you and I drag this subject out about every 5 years and dust it off and re-say it like it's a new thing. And we always get lots of compliments on it. So I want to do it again because I've gotten some questions on it. What's a bear? What's a bull? Where do those things come from? And we say it and just expect everybody to know what we mean when we talk about a bull market or a bear market. And people that have been around the market know what it means. But how in the world did we get a bull and a bear involved? Did somebody come up with a, hey, I'm going to have a mascot. You guys are negative all the time. You guys have a mascot. We're going to choose bears. No, it's not the Chicago sports teams. It is something that goes about 1,000 years back into England. This is a time when the market, when people ask us what the word fair, you know, is the market fair? Well, the market was known as the fair. That's where that word comes from. And this is interesting progression of the word. It was used for a marketplace. And then about 100 years later, it was used in poetry talking about the being equivalent to the word good as a new slang, kind of like the word cool went from being how you discussed temperature to being a reference to somebody who was cool under pressure to just being a statement about goodness. Oh, that's cool. So Where did fair come from? Well, fair came from the market, and then it got changed in poetry and so on to she's fair of face or fair of form. And then eventually the next statement of whether or not it's equally distributed across all sides, fair. And that came from the fair scales that were the licensed scales at the fair. In the marketplace, it was licensed by a lord or by a count or a duke, or in some cases, really important fairs were licensed by the king. And by definition, a licensed fair scale was not evenly balanced. This is one of those things that I tell people when they talk about the word fair at all, is that the very definition of the word comes from something that was not fair by the new definition. The king would weigh one side more than the other. That's how taxes were paid. So when people say pay your fair share of taxes, we're really getting back to the original meaning of the word fair. And it doesn't have anything to do with equal distribution. So keep that in mind. Why did I talk about the word fair when I'm talking about bears and bulls? Because in the fair market, in a good year, when the weather had been good all year, they had a good crop, a good harvest, they could afford to feed extra to their livestock, and they had a lot more bulls than they needed. And we make steers out of bulls today. Back then, they would sell the bulls and eat the bulls because they hadn't progressed far enough to do steers in a way that didn't kill as many as it saved. So the bulls would come to market in droves in good years, and you would sell them, and people would say, oh, this is a bull market because everything's great. Things are wonderful this year. It's a bull market. In a bad weather situation where the droughts had been there, or the winter had stayed on long or whatever, the livestock weren't doing well, but neither were the animals in the forest, and that would cause predators to come out of the forest to attack the livestock, which would cause people to go out and trap those predators and bring them to the market. And bear baiting with dogs, not that that is humane in today's purview, but this is where the word comes from. You would have dancing bears, and you would have bear baiting, and you would have bear fighting during a bear market when you didn't have a lot of bulls because the bears got the bulls that year. So I think that's an important little story, his story, history, for the explanation of why we use the word market the way we do, why we use the word fair the way we do. And market, by the way, just came because you would mark the prices on things. That's really it. You're marking, you're writing stuff to say the prices. So if you have a fair market, it just means that everybody can participate. It doesn't mean that everybody gets a good deal or everybody gets a bad deal or an equal number of people get good deals and bad deals. It simply means that it's a marketplace, a place you can go to buy and sell things. And whether or not it's fair is truly in our minds. Sir John Templeton is the one that says bull markets climb a wall of worry. And he has a better, longer quote that is one of my favorites of all time when it comes to the psychology of the marketplace. And that is, bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. So if you take that as a microcosm, bull markets start on pessimism? How is that? Well, they start in the depths of a bear. That's how you start measuring this. We've had some kind of a collapse and that have extra money available to add to the system are what causes the bull to begin. They say, this is too cheap. I'm jumping and I'm buying this. Now, the people that are saying that have a great deal of hope in their hearts. Hey, I need to buy this. But they are outnumbered by the vast majority of people. And all you have to do is look at headlines. At the depths of a bear market, the headlines are about how bad things are. And at the top of a bull market, the headlines are about how good things are. Both of them include that this is going to go on forever, kind of mixed into the feeling of the message of this is horrible and this is the new normal. Or this is wonderful and this is the permanent plateau of economic prosperity, which is an actual quote from 1929 newspaper right before the massive crash that led to the Great Depression. Why is that? This is pure psychology. Why is it that worry is needed for a bull market to continue? And the reason is that if a lot of people are worried, almost by definition, they haven't invested yet, or they've gotten out of the market, which means there's more money to come into the market. This seems a little weird, but if you took a group of 10 people in a room and you said to them at any given time, how many of you think the market's going to do well over the next 5 years, really, really well over the next 5 years? If this group of people are normal investors, the people that answer that they think that the market is going to do well over the next 5 years are generally pretty well invested already. So you put your money where your mouth is in this kind of optimistic, pessimistic world. If there's a lot of pessimism, it's because people that are pessimistic out there think things aren't going to be good and almost by definition haven't put their money into the market or they've pulled their money out. So the more optimism you see out there, it's kind of a gauge for how many people have already put money into the market. And when everyone's optimistic about where the market's going to be, everybody's like, this is great, it's going to go on forever, just about everybody's put their money in the market. Well, what causes the market to go up? People putting their money into the market. And if everybody's already done that, you've kind of reached the top. And if there's a lot of people that are still worried, then you still have a lot of movement where those people eventually get convinced based on the returns of the people around them. So this is pure psychology. When you're talking about tracking hurricanes or the stress of metals and how much it can put up with, that's pure physics. And you can look at momentum in physics as being a very different thing than momentum in psychology. Momentum in psychology is once you've been wrong in a crowd enough times, well, I think the market's going to crash next month. And you say that enough times and you've been wrong enough times, you change your mind and you say, okay, the market's not going to crash next month. It doesn't mean that it isn't going to crash next month. It's just that I've been wrong enough times, I'm going to change my mind now. So now the market's not going to crash next month. I'm putting my money into the market. And at some point, the last person does that, and that means that the market does crash the next month. And that's just the cycle of the market. There's a psychological aspect of this that leads people to make decisions not based on the reality of the moment. When we see headlines across the board that look at like what they do, like this week we have productivity increases coming out from the Labor Department. And we see the market rocking all over the place, terrified of this, terrified of that. That means we're in good shape for the long term because there's still a lot of people that haven't put their money in the market.
Now, this code of productivity increases coming out from the Labor Department mean there are a few people working in Labor Department doing more paperwork?
Yes, of course. That is totally what I meant. No. This goes on to a news release that's just come out from the Labor Department. They do that, by the way. They release news. John says, negative rates. Why do people keep investing in negative rates when U.S. investments pay positive returns? Is this lack of knowledge or non-availability? Do they just not have access to the market? And that's a fantastic question. And he sent a copy of or a picture of the Wall Street Journal, as he does. Nearly $16 trillion of global debt tracked by Bloomberg Barclays had a negative yield as of July 22nd, meaning investors are locking in a loss by holding it to maturity. Okay, so why are they doing that? When the U.S., you were just saying, well, their interest rate has dropped, but it's still a positive rate. It's still 30% over what it was a year ago. How is this not a good idea? And this is a really good question. If you look at the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar, you'll see that last year at this point, the euro, you could buy a euro for about $1.13. And the exchange rate today is $1.17. It's a five penny increase on cost. It's not quite 5%. It's a little... It's right around the 4% mark as an increase. So a 4% change in the price of the euro against the dollar. The euro is up 4%. If you turn and buy a dollar-denominated bond that just based on the conversion rate drops 4% and it's paying, what is it paying now? 1.3 something, is that what you said?
1.228%.
Okay, so 1.228%, but you lost 4% on the exchange rate, you still have a negative yield. So exchange rates get really complicated. If you're buying in euros, you get a negative yield on the U.S. Treasury right now anyway.
Well, the dollar has risen about 3.3% this year, and that has caused a rush into treasuries because if you're from somewhere else in the world on average and you're using your local currency, converting it to dollars, you did it in January and you bought into the U.S. Treasury when the interest rates are relatively low, your Treasury note or your Treasury security may be worth less today than once you bought it because interest rates have risen since then. But you've got a 3.3% kicker on average. So you actually are making a profit based on currency exchange.
Right. So at the beginning of the year, the euro was trading at $1.21 and now it's $1.17. So just depending on when you buy, that's an extra layer of risk, though, and why people are not flooding out of the European markets into the American markets is because exchange rates may change at any moment.
They actually are pouring into U.S. equities. And the other thing is, if you said, why hang on to treasury security from Germany, let's just say, a Bund, when it's got a negative yield? Well, the answer is, if you're German, and there's a lot of people who are German,
German there, or they'd have nobody to talk to.
Germany is the foundation of the economy. Germany's economy is the foundation of the euro economy. If you're in the European Union and you're buying with euros, there's a tendency to buy and hold locally in the United States as well as in Europe and every place else. Well, not every place else. Some places, all they want to do is get the money out of the country. China is one of them right now.
Would you like to hear the very technical bias name that the behavioral finance folks and behavioral psychologists have come up for that bias based
sure.
on locality? It's called
sure, I'd love to hear it.
The locality bias. Isn't that crazy that they would come up with such an original name for that?
Well, there's a lot of truth in it, because you can sense and feel and have a degree of possession of your local currency.
Right.
People in the United States tend to buy U.S. securities far more than they buy foreign securities. And again, it does add a layer of risk. And you're buying something for 10 years and you're going to hold it for 10 years. It adds a layer of risk to it to buy it in some foreign currency, because that's an additional layer of fluctuation. The dollar could fall at some point.
We got a question.
Yes, we did.
Can you explain what happened in this bull market? And I'm combining those questions. For most people, that would be very strange. Why would you combine things about supply chain and about inflation with a bull market being over and bond?
Bond bull market ending.
Yes.
And to be sure and throw bond in there each time, otherwise people will panic.
Oh, yeah, the stock market's bull is ending. No, we're talking about the bull market in bonds. It's lasted for 40-plus years. As interest rates have fallen over the last 40 years, if you go back in time, and we should play harp music here. I have to find the harp. There we go. Back in time. Going back in time to the late 1970s and early 1980s, that was the end of the bear market in bonds that had lasted about 40 years. And these things go in pretty normal cycles. The cycles are more like they're more based on generational experiences than on like a shorter term thing. Like we would say a cycle in the stock market can be, you know, a typical cycle in the stock market over the last 80 years is about 2.5 years, where you go from bull to bear, or at least correction back and forth. Well, the bond market hasn't experienced that. They are much smoother, which gives them the moniker of being low risk. But there are times when less bumpiness doesn't mean low risk. It means a lot of risk. It's just not a bumpy risk. It's an increasing smooth risk into the future. When interest rates are going up, if you have a whole bunch of money in bonds, your principal is going to go down unless you wait for maturity to receive your money back. And a lot of people tell me how many times you've seen this in the past. I don't know. I guess you're looking at portfolios that aren't managed by us, not quite as often as I am, but I've seen in the last 2 years or so, I've seen probably a dozen portfolios of people in their 70s with a lot of 30-year bonds in it. What that means is that we're treating bonds as if they're just going to be sold on the secondary market, because a 70-year-old with a 30-year bond has to wait that whole 30 years to get maturity. That's age 100 before you see your return of principal. The secondary market has been there to say, hey, I'll buy that from you. Interest rates have dropped since the last time I looked, so I want to pay you more than what you paid. Well, now we're seeing the opposite of that. And that means that for the last 40 years, we've got a habit going that people are very used to. If we look back at the longer patterns in history, it's very normal historically for that to shift and to shock everyone, where they go, what? Bonds have been safe for so long. How am I losing money? We believe that we're seeing that right now. And you've got some statistics that you quote regularly to back that up, I believe. The bull market in bonds. I have to be clear on that.
The end of the bull market in bonds was last year.
Yeah.
Not the peak. The peak was, goodness, long time ago. Well, wait a minute. I guess it was the end of the bull market. So that guy said it was the peak last year. And there's a really good reason. We have a question. Why is it over? What happened to end this bull? Well, bull markets and bonds are generated by falling interest rates. It's that simple. That's all there is to it. I mean, bonds are incredibly complex, far more so than stocks. But as far as bull and bear markets and bonds, it's pretty clear. As long as interest rates are falling, the value of bonds in a portfolio will rise if you have a diversified portfolio. Now, it's also possible to lose money in a bull market in bonds by buying high-yield bonds or something in a company that folds up and lose your money. But when interest rates finally hit bottom, which they do in cycles, and start back up again over a long period of time, then the bull market's over and the bear market has begun. And last year, interest rates hit bottom, bottom, bottom. They were record lows, way below inflation, where it doesn't make any sense to own something that's paying less interest than inflation is likely to be over the age of the bond. People were still buying. They were still flooding the market with money, which, interestingly enough, as people flood the market with money and to buy bonds,
that's what
it causes interest rates to fall.
Right.
And yet they flooded it with more money, which is exactly what happens in the stock market, by the way. When the stock market gets overpriced and it's at the top of a bull market, people tend to flood money into the stock market, which brings it to an unfortunate conclusion. So early on, when I was talking about the markets, the benchmark in the United States for interest rates and on bonds is the 10-year treasury note. I just said it's up 71% this year. The yield is up 71%, which means that the principal has fallen this year, all year.
Not 72%, but a lot.
Yeah.
And in some cases, 50%. I've seen bond portfolios that are down significantly over the last year. It's just scary looking.
If you had a big, matter of fact, I looked in a mutual fund that does a pretty good job of tracking the total bond market in the United States. And it's very, very low expenses. So it's a pretty good idea what's going on. And it's, if you were taking money out of that, if you're taking your interest out of that, you'd have lost about 5% this year so far, just being in that. And the Federal Reserve has clearly said, we're going to be raising interest rates and we're going to be stopping our stimulus, our bond buying program. And as they stop buying bonds over the next year or so, that means there's less demand for bonds, which means the price of bonds will fall and the interest rates will go up, all other things being equal. Of course, anything can happen in the future, but it's the end of that bull market.
Yeah.
It's already over.
So kind of to lay this out and tie it in with, we had another question on the supply chain mess and inflation and so on. Last year, we had a lot of extra money, and that is kind of universal, whether you lost your job or not. When we're looking at statistics, as long as you applied for money, most people had more money last year than in the year before that, incoming new money. Because of all the stimulus, because of all of that, to say, whoa, we got to prevent a massive depression. And it's kind of hard to prove a negative, but we didn't have a massive depression, so it must have worked, right? Well, in the process, it introduced a huge amount of money that people could use as they saw fit. More money than they usually had, except when they got their refund at tax time. Only it was spread out over a longer period of time as more money was coming into them. So they did what people usually do, particularly when they're limited on how much they can spend on their own comfort. They couldn't go out to eat, couldn't go to the movies, couldn't go to a sports game, couldn't go to a concert. So they flooded the markets with it. And a lot of cases, it went into the bond market. Well, as things have become more available to be used again, and the stimulus is not pumping quite as much money into the economy as it was, there's less money on hand because most of it's already either been socked away or something. And now prices are going up because people have extra money and it's harder to get the things that we used to get easily from supply chain issues and so on. So they're beginning to tap their cash that they put away in these low interest rate places and starting to pull that money out of the system. Just like when the Federal Reserve stops buying bonds, there's less money to buy bonds with. That seems very, very obvious. If less people are buying bonds, then less money is buying bonds. That means that the interest rates have to get more competitive. It means that if you want a loan, you have less people offering you a loan. This is why mortgage rates are going up. There's less money being pumped into the loan market to add to loans. There's less money in the bond market. As that happens over time, as other prices go up, you've got to tap your reserves to spend a little bit more on something that costs more than it did. It pulls more money out of those markets, which causes interest rates to go up again. All of this sounds complicated, but as interest rates go up, it gets more expensive to get a loan, which causes people to spend less, as long as the interest rates are going up faster than inflation. And I know that's a lot of variables and a lot of pieces, but if you think you've got a credit card that's going to charge you 5% when you swipe it, or one that's going to charge you 29% when you swipe it, you're more likely to use the money at the low interest rate. And what that means is that you're less likely to use the money when interest rates go up, which means that a lot of the inflation that we're experiencing, the natural cycle competitiveness to that is interest rates will kind of organically go up. At some point, the Federal Reserve may step in and raise them higher if we still have too much money floating around in the system in a couple of years. We got a question.
Yes, we did.
The question is from Don. Don says, I may be misremembering the details, but I'm sure you'll get the point regardless. Back before the virus hit, we could say hit Jeff, but back before the virus hit, Jeff had mentioned, based on long-term indications and the repetitious nature of 20 and 100-year societal behavior cycles, he must have listened to you to be saying societal.
Yes, societal
behavior cycles. That he anticipated corrective downturn in the market around 2023 to 25. My question is how the virus troubles and some business not surviving would affect that forecast. Are the recent troubles weeding out the poor business and so the correction will be smaller? Or is the current situation not affecting the expected correction since it's fairly unique?
Actually, you are misremembering one of the details because we, not just Jeff, saw historical cycles and long-term leading indicators pointing to a cyclical downturn in 2022. And we got one. Now, does that mean that long-term indicators... 2021, 22, not 23 through 25. Does that mean that long... And the reason very simply is 100 years ago, we had one. And we didn't... I'd be the first to say I wish I had been smart enough to realize that. So for some reason, pandemics come every 100 years. I don't know that they do, by the way.
It just happened to this time.
We had a pandemic 100 years ago, too, and we're having a pandemic now, and we're having a market downturn. We just passed through a market downturn that pretty much mirrored the one that occurred in 2021.
In 1922.
Why we do those things in 100-year cycles has been greatly debated by a lot of people, and it really boils down to the point, to the fact that there are forces at work in our socioeconomic system that are not easily explained, but they're clearly there. It's kind of like, we all know gravity exists, but I haven't seen it lately.
Yeah, and Mark Twain says this really, really well. Old Samuel Clemens, he said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Samuel Langhorne Clemens.
Yeah.
Got to get that Langhorne in there.
Well, the concept here is that our behavior is still human.
No, what?
I know, it's strange that we have remained humankind since we started banging rocks together. We are still motivated by the same things. If you doubt that, what is it that someone buys when they win the lottery? Well, they get shelter. A really nice shelter. They get really nice food and they get really nice clothes and really nice. These are all just very, I mean, this is the same stuff that if if a man in medieval England got a bunch of money, somehow legitimately got a bunch of money, what would he improve first? Well, his shelter and his clothes. We haven't changed that much. By that much, I mean we know different languages and we have different cultures, and that does influence our behavior. Like, we're eating different foods. We have different materials that we're building our houses with. But the reality is similar, and we tend to live for relatively normal lifespans as our health gets better. So we're back to a time period in the Roman Empire where the life expectancy reached up into the late 60s and early 70s. And we can see these cycles happening back then in 100-year intervals, only it was really harder to track that. So there's a debate on whether it's just round numbers in the year. Is that what's causing these weird events? No, because they didn't have round numbers in the year in the old Roman calendar before Julius put it into place. They had based on what emperor was in power for how many years. It was very hard to keep calendars accurate at the time.
But for some reason or another, we tend to do things in 10-year cycles. We have a base 10 numeric system. Has something to do with the number of our fingers, I think.
I don't know. I don't know if it has anything to do with that or not. It certainly has something to do with something.
Well, there's 10 and 100-year cycles in sociology that are very clear, that are very repetitive. As a matter of fact, you want to do something fascinating sometime, at least if you're a geek like us, fascinating. Go back and look and see when the major bear markets and recessions have occurred in the history of the United States, and you'll see that most of them, not all, it's not 100%, but it's very, very rare that we have a zero year where we don't have a bear market and a recession. It's extremely rare going back several hundred years. Why is that? Doggone it, I don't know, but I'd love to know. It's kind of like dark matter and dark energy. Dark matter generates 95% of the gravity in the universe, but we have not got a clue what it is or how it works.
We don't even know. Right now, even the term dark matter is still considered a hypothesis. We're just saying somehow gravity is getting made out there and we're going to call it dark matter.
Yeah. And then there's dark energy, which accounts for most of the energy in the universe. And we don't know where that's coming from either.
So there's a lot we don't know, especially about human behavior. What we can say, and we have to be careful using these patterns as predictors if we don't know why they occurred, because the why could change. And to give you a quick example, this is one that's in Elder Baldy's book, which is an interesting name, called The Personal Wealth Coach. It's still available on Amazon. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
It's been, 20 years? Anyway, it's a clear cycle between corn and hog. And it worked. Corn being wheat and barley, rather than corn was a word for just grains, like a peppercorn, something small. And so pigs would get expensive and feed would get cheap because there were fewer pigs eating the feed. So fewer pigs mean more expensive pigs, means cheaper feed. So if you're selling feed, you say, I want to get into pigs. Well, you start buying pigs and that causes the pig price to go up, and everybody's getting out of the feed growing business to go buy pigs, and that means the feed prices go up. So you see what's happening here. If everyone switches on a regular basis between one side and the other, you get this really cool repetitive cycle that's about 3 years long. That's the corn hog cycle. And it went all through history until we had the railroads and cows came into the mix. You need to understand why. So we can look at this behavioral issue. Until we have a good reason why that's the reason why it's happening, we don't make big decisions based on it. We do prepare for it. How's that for weird?
Yeah.
It's really hard to take advantage of it if you don't know when, why, and how. Well, you got part of a win. So it's not as predictive as it looks, but we can base some common understanding. Why is it we could have said 3 years ago, we typically get a pandemic every 100 years. It's something I've studied. But it sounds like I'm predicting a pandemic. Well, I would have been like, well, I did it. I predicted the pandemic. Why? Because 100 years. Why is it 100 years? Do the viruses mutate every 100 years? No, we don't know. And that's the deal. And then if you go back through the history of plagues, they didn't happen every 100 years. We just happened to have one hit in a normal economic cycle that looked like a repeat, but it's nice to point out. We need to play some commercials. We will be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to talk to us, we have emails available during the program at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back after these very important messages. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring
Jeff
and Jake
McClure.
Whoa. With the video, it's actually we're able to say our own names without stumbling on each other. It's crazy. So let's jump into it, shall we?
Let's do it. I wanted to talk about the big picture. For those of you who
is it like a Monet? Is it a Manet? How big a picture are we talking about? How much paint
really,
was used?
A really big picture, more like an Adam Smith.
Whoa. He painted the invisible hand so well you can't even see it.
Well, it's because it's so big.
Yeah, that's probably it.
There was a few months ago, back in the spring and going into early summer, a general consensus among corporations that sometime around Labor Day, things would get back to normal. It's called RTO, return to office. They would basically say the supply chain was going to start cleaning itself up. People would be back in their offices and we could go back to normal business affairs as it was. And they made a lot of plans for that and anticipated a lot of the problems going away that they're facing right now and that they faced at the time. In case you didn't notice, on Labor Day, things did not get back to normal. Didn't even start to get back to normal. Matter of fact, they started getting more abnormal.
Well, I mean, this is a quote I'll give you every time this comes up. Being an adult means repeating to yourself for the rest of your life, things will get back to normal next week. Yeah. So go ahead. That should be in a corporate boardroom somewhere written on the wall.
I like that. Now they're saying the general consensus seems to be that maybe by the end of the year, maybe we'll get back to the office. Maybe supply chains will start to clean up by the end of the year, but they're not even certain of that at this point. So what we're seeing and what's driving this train is COVID-19, specifically the Delta variant. To give you some idea what's going on, I do a chart of the cases per week or the rise in cases in Bell County.
Let me just throw this in here because economically we get this a lot. Why do you guys cover the pandemic so much as economists? Because the pandemic is the elephant in the tiny house. We can talk about taxes. We can talk about all the rest of it. And they are anywhere in size from cockroaches to mice. There's an elephant in the room. Okay, continue.
Back at the end of May and beginning of June, we went 3 weeks in Bell County with no deaths from COVID. We had, for instance, on June 18th, the end of the week that preceded, and these are according to the state, we had 54 new cases of COVID in Bell County and 4 deaths.
So Bell County's in Texas. It's the county that the studio that we have done this operation out of for 20 plus years is.
And on 6/25, the week that preceded, we had 65 new cases, but only 1 death. Well, we're up to 34 deaths a week now and 150 new cases.
Yeah.
And 34 deaths per week in Bell County is the second highest we've ever had. And the hospitals are as full as they've ever been. And that tiny little picture tells you something. There's a restaurant that we were in the habit of eating at every week. Every Wednesday night, we went out with some friends to a restaurant near our house. We looked at the fact that it's been now 8 months since we received our COVID vaccinations, and my wife and I are both elderly, and we both have health issues. So we decided maybe we wouldn't go out to eat Wednesday night at that restaurant with our friends. And sure enough, we couldn't have gone out to eat anyway because the restaurant's closed. Why is the restaurant closed? Because they had several employees test positive or have both asymptomatic and symptomatic COVID. The church we go to is going to be not having a real service again on Sunday. Why? Because we have a confirmed COVID infection going on in the congregation. It's back. And it's having an effect on the economy. That's the big thing. It's having as much as an effect it's having in the United States, and it is having an effect in the United States. It's having a bigger effect overseas. Whole ports have been shut down in China because of COVID infections. Malaysia, many of their factories got shut down because of COVID infections. Their hospitals are full like they are here. People who have, for instance, a heart attack in the United States right now, it's going to be very difficult for them, somebody to get into the hospital and perhaps impossible to get into ICU with a heart attack. That's the secondary effects of these COVID infections that are surging in the United States. In the rest of the world, it's having a similar or larger effect. As what does that mean to you economically? That means that prices, the producer price index, went up almost, well, some aspects of it for goods went up 1% this last month, which is a lot. That's 12% a year. And by the way, it's up 12% from previous year. Why did it go up? Because there's things you want to buy in the United States, and they can't find a single, there's one part missing. I was talking to a manufacturer representative this week, and I said, how is the pandemic affecting your business? He said, well, we've got, and it was a manufacturer of motorhomes. And he said, we can build the motorhomes, but we got one part we can't get. One part, the awning. So we got a bunch of motorhomes. We're building motorhomes. We're putting them on the lot without the awning, and we're running further and further behind on the production of the motorhomes. Well, what does that do?
Well, I could get a job. I can yawn. I can go out there and do yawning.
Awning.
Oh, I can't do awning. I can do yawning.
You'd have to spread out really wide and keep the sun off you. And that's happening across the board. And what does that do? Well, we've talked about the fact that I think the price of used vehicles is up 25% over where it was last year. It was 45% a little earlier. Why? Because of the shortage of new vehicles, and people want a new vehicle. They want a different vehicle. Their old one's worn out or whatever. They're buying used ones instead of new ones, and that's causing inflation. It's causing inflation across the board. You may have noticed, we noticed that the price of food is going up. The price of just lumber is up. The price of just about everything is up, and it's up for a very simple reason. There's a COVID pandemic going on. And until that COVID pandemic gets put to bed and goes away, until it stops filling up the hospitals and filling up the ICUs, we're going to continue to see prices rise. And this is important from our perspective. We're going to continue to see the economy stumble. Now, here's one of the bottom lines to this that I think is important. Remember, I said that the producer price index has risen a lot over the last year. Producer price index for goods has risen over 12%. There's something called the PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditure Index,
right,
which is the one that the Federal Reserve uses, and it's probably the most accurate measure of inflation. It's up 3.6% over the last year, which is not too bad. Wait a minute. Producer price index measures wholesale prices. How much does it cost for the retailer who's going to sell it to you? How much are they paying for the stuff they're selling? and it's up 12% in the last year. But the price they're charging to the public is only up 3.6%. What does that mean? That means that the company that's selling the stuff, which is an economic term,
is lowering their profit margin.
It's squeezing the profit margin. And that is generating some concern out there among people who are watch this type of thing, including us.
Per item profit margin, I should say. And if they're selling enough new things by eating that cost, they could be increasing their profit margin by lowering their per item profit margin. We're seeing a lot of earnings are going up. So it's not like we're seeing the profit margin being squeezed. They're selling enough new things to make up for not increasing their prices as fast as their costs are increasing. But there's a limit to that.
Here's the concern. Last time retail spending was reported, which was for August, it dropped 1.1%.
Yeah.
Which means people are buying less stuff.
They're still buying more things than they were pre-pandemic.
Yes.
And it's dropping down. That's why they're buying less stuff, because we're going back to more normal.
But the point is, if they're buying a little less stuff and the profit margin on the stuff they're buying is being
squeezed,
restricted.
Yeah.
Then the concern is that third quarter earnings by corporations that are publicly traded will come in lower than expected.
So what you're saying is that if people buy fewer things and the profit on each thing is less, profits will go down?
Corporate profits may. No.
Wow. It's true.
I don't think they go down. They just grow at a slower rate.
Yeah.
Right now, the market is priced for a certain rate of growth in the economy, a certain rate of growth in corporations. And that prices the growth side of the market, the large cap growth, which drives the S&P 500. And the concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern and one that we need to be prepared for, is we may soon begin to see third quarter estimates come in at a lower rate of growth. It's not like we're sliding into recession. China is at risk of sliding into recession, and it's being generated by the COVID-19 pandemic. India is in trouble. Vietnam's in trouble. They may be able to bail themselves out. They may not. They're on the edge. The United States is still growing, but I suspect the third quarter growth rate will be lower than was expected, and the third quarter earnings growth rates maybe need to be adjusted down. Now, this is not a bad thing. It doesn't mean we're going into recession. It doesn't mean that things are sliding backwards. But it's important to remember that the stock market is largely driven by earnings. And if earnings come in at a lower growth rate than was expected, some of the speculators might suddenly decide they need to go someplace else. And if that happens at the same time that the Federal Reserve begins to pull back on their stimulus, interest rates could rise at the same time. So what you could get is bonds going up, stock market going down. In other words, we are seeing, and by the way, this is the ideal time of year for it.
Yeah. We're getting right into October. Yeah. So
we're seeing a setup that could generate a correction.
Now,
and it's something that we need to be prepared for.
And having said that, this is the piece of education that when people hear us say something like that, they go, oh, I need to get out of the market.
No.
Absolutely not what we're saying. It is always a good idea to know why you're in a thing before you get out of the thing. It's probably, and I would say probably with like 100% degree of certainty, it's better to know why you're in the thing before you get into the thing. If you're uncomfortable being in the thing, it shouldn't have anything to do with what's going on in the market right now. It should be, hey, you're not comfortable with the concept of it going down, then don't be in it if it's something that looks really risky. So getting out of the market to prevent being in it during a correction is one of the worst mistakes smart market movers do. And it's repeated so often, I don't even know how to underline this more. When people hear, hey, we might have a correction, and then they jump out of the market, well, when do you get back in? What you do to prepare for a market correction is look at it and say, I can expect this thing to be, a correction's down 10%. I could expect this thing to be down 10% or more, and I just need to sit through that. So long as you're well-diversified, and you believe that the American economy is going to recover into the future, it's not going to fade slowly into some haunted memory of itself. We're not seeing signs of that. The innovation that we're seeing, the new product development, the technological advancements that are all centraled here say everything the opposite of that. So getting out of the market to it's kind of like not deciding not to go on vacation because it might rain on the first Monday. You don't make decisions like that if you're talking about a 3-week vacation. You say, oh, that first Monday, we'll figure something else out. You say, I'll be prepared for that. I'll bring an umbrella. That's what we talk about in the market, is that if you believe that the U.S. economy is doing well and the economy of the world is likely to grow, then being invested, well-diversified, even when we have the market go down, especially when we have the market go down, is the reason why you've gotten this great historical return. Because it's like faith in our system, whoever is in charge of it. And I think there have been enough changes in who's in charge over the last 10 to 15 years to realize who's in charge has a lot less control than we thought they did, or maybe more control than we thought they did. It's like the things we're afraid of them having control over, they don't have a lot of control over because we're afraid of it. But the things that we haven't considered yet, they have too much control over. It's just the way our system works. All that being said is we're not recommending diving out of the market here. We are always recommending that you look at why you are, where you are, and determine what you would do if that was in a much lower situation. Would it make you sell? Well, then you should probably be out of it now, when it's not lower, when you could make a profit getting out of it. I know. Common sense is weird.
It's very important to recognize that market timing, determining that the market's going to go down, so bailing out, and then getting back in when you think it's the bottom, historically has proven to be the worst form of investing.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, during long periods of time, people who do market timing almost inevitably lose money. People who just hang in there and recognize that that a bump is coming and ride through the bump generally do quite well. And I think it's important, though, that we know it's coming. I say know it's coming. I say I can't tell you for certain anything about the future. What I can say is market corrections happen, and it's very rare for the stock market to double in value, and it has effectively doubled in value since the bottom in March of 2020. It's very rare for the stock market to double in value without a correction. And a correction is a drop of 10% in the stock market. And so what I'm saying is, buckle your seatbelts. I would not be surprised to see a bump in the road.
And we're about out of time for this week. Thank you all for listening. We love doing this, and we're really, really thankful for those of you that take 2 hours out of your week to sit and listen to us. And we are definitely sorry for the brain damage that's occurred because of it. We appreciate you guys more than we can say. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have phone numbers locally with voicemail. If you have a need for technical advice on investments or need fiduciaries to work with you for large amounts of assets, there's a local number with voicemail during the weekends and real live people during the week at
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, or email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.